We're now on talk 12 in the discipleship series, and we've been looking at various features and things that were involved in being a disciple, what it leads to, what it involves, and so forth. Let's look at this one, being salt and light. So it's the duty of a disciple to be salt and light in this world. That's one of our purposes and objectives, if you're a real disciple. So each one of us is meant to be like a lamp, meant to bring light wherever we go, lighting up the darkness of the sin and ignorance that's in the lives of the people around us. And that involves being an influence for good, helping others to know the truth, and so on. But, of course, that's being a light. But our duty goes beyond just being a light. So we're also meant to be salt and to be practical help to the poor, the sick, the elderly, the weak, the dying. So I see this as two sides of what a disciple is meant to be. So he's meant to be both bringing light and bringing the truth, bringing instruction, bringing the gospel and so forth, but also making a practical difference to meet the material needs of the people around us. And frequently those are seen as sort of alternatives. You either do this or you do that. But really, we're meant to be both of those things. So, Chris, can you read out Matthew 5, 13 to 16?
You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven.
Yes, so those are the things we're meant to be. But although Jesus speaks here of how people will see our good works and give glory, frequently they will, and many will respond to what we do. Many will respond to our being salt and respond to our being light by coming to the gospel and by turning to him. That will happen. That's the objective. But we mustn't imagine that everybody will do that, because although a light is a good thing, we can't expect that the unbelieving world will agree that a light is a good thing, because men are evil and they like darkness. And so to the world, a light is a threat. It's an affront. And that's why a believer who lives in a righteous way, his very life becomes a rebuke to people around him. So simply by being, simply by existing, a Christian, without meaning to rebuke anyone, simply by existing is a rebuke. And many, many a time I've come across this in my own life and in the lives of others, where simply by being in a workplace or even in a church where unrighteous things are happening, your very presence, even if you don't say a word, is a rebuke, because people know what you stand for and they feel rebuked by your life, by your lifestyle, by your values. So as a disciple, we are meant to go out there and make a difference, a practical difference in the world, helping the poor, the needy, and so on. But that's not inconsistent with being a light and telling the truth about the gospel, about the Bible, and so forth. And I emphasise that because these are frequently seen as being mutually exclusive alternatives. Or at any rate, even if people don't put it into those words, they choose one or the other. And we don't have to choose one or the other. We're meant to be both of these things. But that doesn't mean that we can't have an emphasis. So some people will have an emphasis on preaching and teaching and so on, and others will have more of an emphasis on good works, helping the poor, the needy and the sick and so forth. Of course there'll be emphasis, but that emphasis should not go so far as to be an exclusion of the alternative, whereby you say, no, I'm a good works person, I don't do light, or I'm a light person, I don't do salt. We're meant to do both, notwithstanding that the proportions can differ and will differ for each of us. So the reason I say that is because there are many people who follow what you might call a social gospel, whereby they underemphasize or even ignore anything that has to do with preaching about repentance or the gospel or the need for sinners to be saved, they don't like that. They preach a very different gospel about simply making a difference in the world. Do you see? And so in order to pursue that, the proclamation of the gospel, which is seen as a hindrance to that or even as an embarrassment, is downplayed or even removed, and you end up with just a social gospel. But you can have an alternative to the social gospel, which is a completely wrong thing to be. You can have an alternative whereby you just have the preaching of the gospel and no involvement in anything that might constitute good works or anything like that, for fear that that's either wasting our time or it's not important, or even that it's the wrong thing to do. And that's why, for example, vast numbers of Christians have nothing at all to do with politics, won't have a thing to do with it. And do you know, not just the active involvement in political parties, which I think many Christians should have, but they won't even vote. And did you know that 54 million American evangelicals of voting age did not vote at the last presidential election? They just didn't vote. 54 million didn't vote. Now imagine if even a fragment of those had said, I need to wake up and go out and vote, Obama would never have got in. So you have the most godless, wicked man elected, whilst the Christian community just lies in a coma asleep. And yet it wasn't only because they were in a coma asleep. Many of them proudly proclaim the fact that they don't vote as if it's a virtue, as if there's something godly about not voting. And so I would go further than just voting. We ought to be actively involved in things, writing to newspapers, speaking up at public meetings, joining political parties, any party. It doesn't have to be a particular party. You can join the Labour Party, you can join the Conservative Party, Liberal Democrats, join the Democratic Party in America or the Republican Party. There's no particular need to join a particular one. A Christian could or should join most parties. And whatever matches your sort of interests, preferences, where your opinions lie. Because God is quite happy for you to have opinions. If you've got opinions about how to solve unemployment or how to deal with inflation or urban regeneration, go and have your opinions and go and let them lead you into whatever party you want to go into. But when you're in it, then be a Christian in that party. Be a Christian in that group. Now that's what ought to happen, but it isn't what's happening. And I can remember when I was a young believer, because I was very interested in politics, but also interested in the Bible and in the gospel. And there was a chap that was 2-3 years older than me when I was a student, and he was scathing of all political involvement by me or anyone, and he brushed it aside and said that we should have nothing to do with it. And his words were, we should just preach the gospel. And that's what he believed. Now the point is, where does he get that idea from? That doesn't come from the Bible. That in itself is an opinion. But for him it was a given, it was an obvious truth that we should just preach the gospel. But you cannot find in the Bible support for the proposition that you should just preach the gospel. The Bible supports the proposition that you should preach the gospel, but it doesn't. The adding of the word just renders that untrue. You should not just preach the gospel. You should preach it, but not just. You're also meant to be salt, and you're meant to be a light. And you can be a light in the world in more ways than just by preaching the gospel. You can be a light by being on a school governing body, by being in a political party, by being, you name it. And the irony is that because the apathy of our wider society is so staggering, the active involvement in political parties today is at an alarmingly low level. You know, it's astonishingly low. And so in a constituency, you would have just a a handful of active people now. It's even worse in the Labour Party. It's bad enough in the Conservative Party, where they lack membership. But the Labour Party has even lower membership. And what's happening, it's like with the election of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, the only people sort of actively involved now in the Labour Party are the kind of crazies who would vote for him. And so the MPs are horrified at the election of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader. But why was he elected? Because the wider membership of the Labour Party wanted Corbyn. Now that could not have happened in a previous generation. But because the membership is so low, and because so many of them are very far removed from Christianity, a man such as him would come to the fore. But you see, if even a fragment of the number of Christians in this country joined political parties, of all parties, it would mean that no matter who gets elected, a Christian influence is being heard. And I labour this because in my own case, this was to me obvious, and I've been involved in politics all through my life, but I've had almost no encouragement in that. I've had a modicum, a little smidgen of encouragement at times, but in the main, on the whole, it's been assumed by church leaders that what I was doing was a complete irrelevance at best, or at worst, the wrong thing to be doing. Do you see? So just maybe that someone's listening to this now on tape for whom this is an issue, and I would urge them to go ahead. If that's what you feel God is leading you into, go for it, because it is a right and proper thing to be doing. So we're not to take a sort of one-sided approach where we either go for the gospel or for helping the poor and needy. You're meant to be able, as a disciple, to chew gum and walk at the same time, and to have the ability both to be a light and to be salt. And you can't just pick and choose which of God's commands are to be obeyed and which can be put to one side or considered inapplicable to you. Okay, let's move on to another issue, and this is the way in which, as a disciple, remember, all of these things are the things that will happen to a disciple. One of the things he will do is to refine you, just as a jeweler smelts and purifies silver or gold and so on by heating it to a great heat, and he will do that in your life. He'll do this whether you ask him to or not, but he'll do it particularly if you ask him to. And later on I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a few talks from now, about how God operated like this in my life. But he will do this if you're a disciple. He will put you under pressure. He will put you into situations of difficulty, stress, pressure and problems of one kind and another. Often at work, could be in other contexts as well, all sorts of ways, and he'll do it to effectively, it's like putting a Bunsen burner under you and heating you up to a high temperature to get the dross out of your life. Because we're all, as we enter into the Christian life, a mixture of good things and bad, good habits and bad habits, good qualities and bad qualities, sensible ideas and foolish ideas, good attitudes and bad attitudes. At best, that's the best we are, is a mixture. At worst, we're just a basket case. But at best, we're a mixture. And he takes that mixture and he says, right, what's needed here is a Bunsen burner underneath you. Everyone know what a Bunsen burner is in chemistry, where you heat up the chemical and apply the flame to it as part of that refining process. And he will do that to you, to take away the dross and burn up the wood, hay and stubble. Now this is a process that's ongoing. He'll do it now in this life. He's also going to do it at the judgment seat. The process will be completed there. And so what he'll do at the judgment seat, one of the things he'll do, is to entirely remove from you the wood, hay and stubble. And one of his reasons for doing so is because, as part of the process of judgments, he wants to evaluate the proportion of gold, silver and precious stones that you have now, at the end of your life, accumulated. So he's wanting to establish the degree to which your life consists of those things. And he does it by removing the remainder of the wood, hay and stubble. But wouldn't it be nice if you could cooperate with him and get rid of as much of the wood, hay and stubble now as you can, so there's less to be burned up on the final day at the judgment seat? I'd like him, I don't suppose it's going to happen, but I'd like him to say, oh, there's virtually no wood, hay and stubble here to be burnt up. Wouldn't it be nice if he said that? And because you've cooperated with me to such an extent that during your life as a disciple, I've regularly been applying the Bunsen burner to you, and it's pretty much all gone now. That's what you want. But how likely is it that, isn't it much more likely that you'll achieve that if you're cooperating with it than if you're not? Isn't it more likely that that will be achieved if you know it's an objective of his, and you not only are aware of it, but say, come on, let's do this, I'll cooperate with you. And so that's what we should be doing. And Chris, why don't you just read out this passage here, just to illustrates this, from 1 Corinthians 3, 10 to 15.
According to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation, and someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care how he builds upon it, for no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's works will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire.
So that passage from 1 Corinthians 3 is talking about the judgment seat and the process that will be gone through at that to remove the dross and to expose the dross and expose also the precious stones and gold and silver. But there's also this process going on during this life. So if you could read Malachi 3, 2 to 3.
But who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. He will sit as a smelter and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver, so that they may present to the Lord offerings in righteousness.
Yeah. So those two passages are both speaking about how Jesus is going to do this to us. He's going to refine us. And he's going to do it on a huge scale when he returns. But the point is, he's doing it now. He's doing it now to you. And one of the ways that he does it, one of the biggest ways he does it, think, what do you spend 8 hours of your day, waking day, doing? You're 8 hours in bed, 8 hours at work, and 8 hours doing other things. Now, if you were God, when would you be doing the smelting, the confronting of difficulties and attitudes, the dealing with problems? You're going to be doing it in work time, aren't you? He's limited as to what he can do when you're asleep. You've got 16 waking hours. Half of your waking life is spent at work. So why would God not use those hours? Why would God not use half your waking life? As many assume, and I labour this, because I've come across this attitude so many times, that our working life is irrelevant to Christianity, and that it's got nothing to do with anything. It's just a thing that you do to get a wage, and it's got nothing to do with your life as a disciple, or your growth of character, or your ministry, or anything at all. But in fact, your working life is of profound importance in so many ways, but including in this way. It's the place where the Bunsen burner gets applied to you. And I was only mentioning to someone the other day the need to think of your job as a way where you actually go outside of your comfort zone and expect to go outside of it. And I mention that because a lot of folk think that their job should be comfortable, should be easy. They want it to be easy. They want to stay in familiar things, doing familiar tasks that they know how to do. They don't want to be stretched. They don't want to face difficulty. They don't want to face stress. They don't want to have to learn new things, try new things, deal with difficulties, and so on. But actually, it's in many of those things that God is stretching you. And when I was a young trainee solicitor, I used to volunteer for every dangerous mission going. And I learned so much more than some of the others did. Because I remember one particular girl who was a trainee the same time as me, Article Clerk we were called then. And she always wanted a comfy day, doing familiar, regular things that she knew how to do already. More of the same she wanted. As I wanted totally different things I'd never done before. But the price of doing different things you've never done before is stress, hard work, difficulty, staying up till midnight the night before researching something that you've never done before is pressure. But you learn so much faster and so much better. And also it exposes in you character issues that need to develop. And so I would counsel people, use your job, let your job be used for this process of growing in character, smelting and purifying and refining, and how you deal with situations in that is part of this. But your whole life is part of this, but your job especially. And so the thing is as well, given that you know that this process is going to happen at the judgment seat, I mean it's happening now too, but given that you know it's happening and is going to happen in a bigger scale, doesn't it make sense to try and bring forward the judgment process now into the present and cooperate and ask God to expose things now through difficulties, through problems, through however he wants? Ask him to expose your errors, your sins, your bad attitudes, your wrong approach. The number of bosses who God has used to point out the deficiencies in me, I think God was onto their case the whole time and saying to them, to inspectors and sergeants and senior lawyers, to go over and tell that chap, go and tell him this, go and tell him that, tell him about his attitude about this. And at the time I wasn't rampagingly in favour of them doing this, but as I look back at it, I can see these fellas weren't doing it entirely of their own volition. I think God was using them as his undisclosed agents to bring about these changes. But if you know that and cooperate, you'll receive a far better service of correction and refining than you will if you resist it at worst or are unaware of it even at best. So cooperate with it. And the more that you let him do that to you, the more you let bosses correct you, point out your errors, other people point out your deficiencies, the less Jesus will have to rebuke at the judgment seat. Wouldn't it be better to hear it now from some inspector that you need to change in this way or that, or from some senior lawyer or from some senior doctor or from some manager, than to hear it from him? Anyway, think about that. So that sort of self-examination and cooperating with letting others point out your problems is enlightened self-interest, and we should seek as much correction and constructive criticism as we can get here and now. Welcome it. And any embarrassment or discomfort that it causes is only temporary. And you'd be a fool to shelter yourself from all of that for purposes of just making today an easier day at the cost of what will happen later. So let's look at another issue. When you become a disciple, if you're going to be a disciple, God will begin to treat you as his own child. You might think, well, that's great. If God's going to treat me as his own child, that's a terrific thing. Well, it is. You'd be quite right to say that. But there's a catch here. If he's going to treat you as his own child, that means he's going to discipline you and even punish you. Well, that doesn't sound quite as good. But that's an aspect of being his child. And he does it for your own good, to help you to grow up. So, because in so much of the Western Church there's an overemphasis on God's love and on God just being, you know, non-stop cuddling us and cozying up to us and being really lovey-dovey with us all the time, and that's how it's seen and portrayed, which of course he is like that. Every good parent is like that at times. but not all the time. And the point is this, that that error of that misguided overemphasis causes many of us to assume that God would never rebuke or discipline us if we're a Christian. And in fact, the opposite is the case. The very fact that God disciplines us is one of the things that proves that we're his children. Because nobody goes around rebuking other people's kids and giving them a smack. But the very fact that you are rebuking or disciplining a wayward child is prima facie evidence that you are its parent. And that's what I would conclude if I saw that happening. And so we need to expect to be treated as God's children, but we need to understand the wider implications of that. And that it doesn't just mean that he's going to keep giving us lollipops and nice things. It also means being disciplined and punished when that is required. And just because this is such a controversial area, I've got a few quotes here from the Bible just to prove that this is the case, and that I'm not making it up. So, Chris, why don't you begin with Deuteronomy 8:5-6.
Know then in your heart that, as a man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you. So you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God by walking in his ways and by fearing him.
And then if you can read this lengthy passage from Hebrews 12:5-11.
And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them. But he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it.
Yeah. So, the very fact that God disciplines us is actually the proof that he loves us. It's not the proof that he doesn't love us. And because he knows that we need it and benefit from it. And if you can read out Psalm 94:12.
So, the very fact that God
Psalm 94:12.
Blessed is the man whom thou dost chasten, O Lord, and whom thou dost teach out of thy law.
Psalm 94:12. And then Deuteronomy 8:16.
That he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end.
That's right. So, and here's a good one. In case people think that reproof and discipline are evidence that God doesn't love us, what about this? Revelation 3:19.
Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline. So be zealous and repent.
So therefore, you need to have a correct understanding in lots of ways of what discipleship involves and what being God's child involves, and broaden that to include all the things that it involves, not just the things that you personally like or have been told are involved in that, but everything that the Bible says is involved in that. Open up your mind to be broad enough to see all of those things. So, God's aim in doing this, in disciplining us, is to change us and mature us. He wants us to change. This is the key point. He does not want us just to stay as we are. So if you've got a five-year-old, who wants their five-year-old to stay like a five-year-old? You like your five-year-old, you love your five-year-old, but you don't want your five-year-old to stay like a five-year-old. You want them to change, don't you? And you also recognize that that's an ongoing process. You want them to change, grow up, mature, learn, gain self-control, and change in 101 different ways. So God will use chastisement as part of that process, and he will certainly use it sometimes up to a very high level of chastisement, sometimes where it's very severe. But hopefully he will not take it to the level of ending our lives. So in most cases, he will not do that. So if you could read out Psalm 118:18.
The Lord has disciplined me severely, but he has not given me over to death.
So what the psalmist is speaking of there is that God has put him through intense pressure and stress and strain, but not given him over to death, not to the point where it ends his life. But that rather suggests that the pressure he's being put under is pretty severe. So if he's saying, I'm getting this discipline, but not to the point of death, well, that doesn't support the view of those who think that discipline, insofar as it is ever given, is at a very low level. The psalmist, obviously, the discipline that he has had is plainly at a very high level, even for him to need to point out that it hadn't reached the level of death. So it's like saying, I've been in to see my boss and I've been rebuked and disciplined, but not the death penalty. Do you see? Your colleagues at work would look askance at that, wouldn't they? The point is, this is sometimes the extent of the discipline that God gives us. It can be very severe and very, very pressurized. But what I want to go on to speak about, having emphasized that mostly God's discipline does not involve death, I want to go on to speak about some circumstances that can arise exceptionally where actually God will choose to end the life of a person. And I'm going to speak about situations where he does so for an unbeliever and where he does so even for a believer, even for a saved person. So this is a complex area, and it's one that, again, as with so many areas, it's never spoken about because it's not comfortable. It's not something cozy or comfy. But this is an area we need to face up to, and I'm going to look in the next talk as well about some instances where this has arisen and it still arises. And so let's begin, if you could begin, Chris, just to preface this by reading this lengthy passage, 1 Corinthians 10:1-12.
I want you to know, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same supernatural food, and all drank the same supernatural drink, for they drank from the supernatural rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things are warnings for us, not to desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to dance. We must not indulge in immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put the Lord to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as a warning, but they were written down for our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed, lest he fall.
Yes, now Paul is there speaking of the generation that came out of Egypt. Now remember, that was an unusual generation, and God's handling of that generation was unusual precisely because of the enormity of the revelation they'd had. Now, they had had personal involvement with Moses. They'd listened to Moses, heard him. They'd heard him giving direct instruction to them, but not only that, they had also witnessed the plagues in Egypt. They'd seen God move supernaturally on repeated occasions. They had also gone through the Red Sea and seen it parted by God with the waters standing on either side. They'd seen the Egyptian army drowned in it after they went through. And they'd seen all this. They'd had the law given to them. They'd have had so many things done for them. They'd had manna every morning. Miraculous food appears on the ground for them. And they've had years of this. But the point is that where there is great revelation, where God gives understanding and insight and instruction and knowledge, and in particular where he gives personal revelation of himself. I mean, they'd seen the pillars of fire and they'd seen all this. Where he gives all that kind of revelation, he expects more. And so many, many, many of that generation, God allowed them to die in the wilderness. So many of them were just kept in the wilderness until they died, because he wouldn't let them go into the land. So that was one thing he did. But in addition to that, many of them were just wiped out by God. They were killed by God. They were put to death. And so some of them were unsaved people. Undoubtedly they were. But some of them were not necessarily unsaved people. So we can't put them all into the category they were all unsaved. Some of the people whose lives God ended, either by directly putting them to death or by causing their death prematurely in the wilderness. Because remember, nobody over the age of 20 got out of the wilderness except for Joshua and Caleb. Everybody that came into the promised land had been young, 20 or younger, when they left Egypt. Do you see the point? Therefore, apart from Joshua and Caleb, the oldest person that entered the promised land was 60. Do you see that? That entire generation was wiped out by God. Why? Well, in particular, they were treated at the upper end of the spectrum because they had had such a massive revelation. And you might say, well, that's fine then, because these fellas had a great revelation, whereas we have had far less of a revelation. Well, where are you getting the idea that you've had a lesser revelation than them? You've got the entire Bible. You've got Christian books galore. You've got the internet. You've got websites. You've got MP3s. You've got preaching online. You've got YouTube. You've got all these things that you've got whereby God can give you revelation. You've got 29 versions of the Bible on your phone and 100 commentaries. You've got all those things which they didn't have. Some of their phones didn't even have access to Wi-Fi. And the point is that you've got so much more than them. At any rate, you can't simply say, brush it aside and say, these people had far greater revelation than me. And yes, in some ways they did. Yes, they saw the Red Sea parted. But you know, the point is, I might as well have seen the Red Sea parted, because I believe it to the same extent as if I'd seen it. I don't doubt one jot that the Red Sea was parted. That being so, haven't we got, in one sense, an equal revelation to them? I think in many ways we have. So, although God taking the life of a person is a rare response, it's not the thing that he normally does. You need to be aware of it, that it does form part of what he does. And God will discipline some people to the extent of taking their life, either by premature death, as happened to the Israelites in the wilderness, or by the direct taking of a person's life. And I'm just introducing this point now because this is something we're going to go on to talk about in the next talk. But what I want to say is that some of the people to whom that happened were saved and had eternal life. They were not all unbelievers whom God was judging because they were unbelievers. The point is that some of them were believers, but God still took the lives of some of those people. At any rate, the point is that God, I want to make this clear, one of the things that God will do in certain situations is to actually kill the wrongdoer. He'll actually slay people. And look at this, admittedly from the Old Testament, but Chris, if you can read Exodus 22, verses 22 to 24.
You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless.
Now, would you agree that that's bordering on being quite an assertive statement there by God as to the way he conducts himself? I mean, most of us, if that was said to us by someone, we would not take it very well, would we? But that's what he's saying to the people of that generation coming out of the Exodus. And he said he would do that, and he did that, didn't he? And these are the things we need to take seriously. And in keeping with the way that we are meant to look at the whole Bible, we're not just meant to think, oh, how glad I am that I'm not like these people. How glad I am that I'm a much better person than them, and thus not likely ever to encounter this kind of treatment from God, because I'm so much better than these people and don't have any of their faults or failings. Isn't that fortunate? Now, that's the attitude we can't afford to have. So we need to take it seriously, and I'm going to look now in the next talk at some of other instances where God has moved in severe judgment, including in the lives of believers.